I've known our next speaker, Dr. Wheelis, since she was a resident in the late 1980s at McLean Hospital. Even then, her indomitable authoritative style were combined with a remarkable warmth and generosity that was confusing and alluring. In the years after her residency, she quickly became a magnetic teacher, supervisor, consultant, and leader of clinical programs at McLean Hospital. During that time, she often flattered me by suggesting that her achievements were borrowed off of things she'd learned from me, but she put a lie to that soon enough by surpassing me in many ways. She became a training analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Institute. She developed a clinical program for treatment of borderline patients in the Cambridge community that was became a landmark for high-quality DBT treatment. She became a DBT trainer and a star in Marshall Linehan's orbit. She introduced new standards of monitoring adherence in the staff at her clinical program. She's now coming back to McLean in a new way to oversee and try to sustain the same standards of DBT that she developed at her own program in the new clinical program that's being the new residential program that we're opening in Cambridge. I welcome her back into that role, and I welcome her speech and the talk that's soon to follow. So please join me.
Well, thank you, John, very much for that very kind and lovely introduction. As we always like to say to one another, there's a lot of water under the bridge. But anyway, I'm very flattered and honored to be here today to introduce this. Of course, I have to think to myself that I'm here introducing DBT because I'm an analyst, which I think is in and of itself a kind of interesting thing. But the truth of the matter is, that's what I do. I'm both a DBT therapist and an analyst, and I actually like doing both. I can't say that there's much crossover, although I wonder about that. Sometimes I think I'd like to have somebody look at my work and tell me whether that's true or not, or whether it's all blended together. But I think my interest in both, and maybe in particular in DBT, has to do in large measure with my particular interest in how insight leads to action. And I've always been interested in this, and I've come to appreciate over the years how incredibly difficult it is to change. So DBT is a treatment modality I'm sure you all know, developed by Marshall Linehan at the University of Washington. And I think, as Dr. Bateman said, she would probably say the same thing, that there's really nothing particularly new about it. She's borrowed upon old traditions, many different things that have been in the biz for a long time, but it put it together in interesting ways and drew upon other things that one didn't usually associate with psychotherapies. DBT grew out of an iterative attempt on her part to apply behavioral principles to highly suicidal clients with borderline personality disorder. She would sit in a room and conduct therapy with all of her graduate students and colleagues, watching her do it, taking notes on what they felt was effective and not. So as I'm going to present this today, I'm also going to take you into my world of seeing DBT as an analyst. So this is a somewhat different presentation. I'm going to go much more over sort of my general thoughts about DBT, and in the afternoon session get into more of the particulars. I think as a background story, you know, I worked with John for years and years and saw many borderline patients, and for the most part, the therapies went very well and they got better. But there was something that occurred in me as time went on, when the therapies did not work well, when the common refrain was, I don't think they're ready for treatment. And this used to stick with me a lot, because I would think, well, if they're not ready for treatment, how are they going to get ready for treatment? And what really does that mean? Are they going to go out and do something? Is this about maturation? Are they going to have life experiences that are going to be so severe that they're going to come back to treatment? What is that? And so one of the things that has impressed me about DBT is that it's a dialectical treatment. I think that sort of attends to some of the thoughts we have that Dr. Kernberg was bringing up about splitting. It's a way in which to acknowledge that and have a way of addressing how you find an interim path. It's behavioral in that it's based on learning theory and contingencies. It's also a very relational model. One of the things that always has impressed me, and I think people forget about, is in the targeting in DBT, the second most important thing after suicidal behavior, self-injurious behavior, is therapy interfering behavior, which of course has a tremendous amount to do with the relationship. DBT promotes accountability and responsibility. That's no particular claim on this treatment or against others, but it's a very important one to me. I think I've always been very interested in the dual roles of therapists and patients in promoting both a sense of responsibility and accountability in one another. I think in DBT, one of the things that struck me immediately is that all therapies are videotaped, and the patient is encouraged, if not expected outright, to audiotape the sessions and listen to them outside of the session for further learning that occurred. This is the kind of thing that I feel is tremendously important in the setting up of expectations within a relationship, as well as developing a sense of attachment between therapist and patient, which down the line can be used as a major contingency. DBT therapy examines behavior that is current, past, as well as in session. One of the things in coding adherence is to note whether there's anything in the room going on when you sit down with a fairly programmed protocol for conducting a session. If you see any kind of affect of anything that is vague, you don't understand what's going on, that is the first order of business to determine what is happening with the patient. One of the main differences from psychodynamic treatments is that it looks at behavior as thoughts, actions, feelings, sensations, urges, everything that can be observable, as studied, as events in time without the presumption of unconscious motive. The function of behavior is examined as it's the function on the environment and the contingencies which maintain it. Unconscious meaning of behavior is not part of behavioral paradigm. The mysteries of therapy are operationalized in terms of behavior which can be empirically studied. This was a hard one for me. I didn't want to let that go. I used to feel that the marvelous symbolic meanings of behavior that I could wonder endlessly about in terms of their multiple meanings being reduced to contingencies on behavior and antecedents and consequences seemed like a cruel loss to me, but one that I've come to find incredibly useful. I haven't given up on the symbolic meaning, but I can't help now but think about what were the cues that preceded something. It's a principle-driven treatment that does include protocols. I think that's important. I think because of the type of book that Dr. Lenihan wrote, it's so detailed, it's like reading an encyclopedia, that one thinks that it is really a series of protocols to be employed, but it is not. It's a very principle-driven treatment. Principles being in that it is informing the course of treatment, protocols being a specific course of treatment with clear how-to instruction, as in the protocol for panic disorder treatment. There's a lot of outcome data. I'm not going to spend any time really on this. Just to highlight, there have been 10 randomized trials completed, several different sites, many others in progress right now, and that the outcomes... Okay, now what do I do, Chris? Why is this black here? Okay. It reduces suicide attempts and self-injury, premature dropout, it's reduced inpatient and ER admissions and days, some drug abuse, depression and hopelessness, and has increased both global and social adjustment and positive self-esteem. So what I'm going to talk about is go over the theoretical conceptualization, and then some of the common therapy problems that actually brought me very much involved in this treatment. And once I've found that the solutions offered by DBT have been enormously helpful for me in terms of being much more comfortable in a treatment that works with severely disturbed patients who are often on the verge of killing themselves. And then I'll give a little bit of time to the latter aspects, the frame, the nature of the behavioral therapy, validation, dialectics, and the notion of practice in DBT, all of which I'll go into much more in the afternoon session. So, like we've heard earlier, these three major traditions have reorganized the way in which we look at the disorder. And Dr. Lenihan, in talking about the biosocial theory, recognizes that the underlying problem is a series of dysregulations, emotion dysregulation being the overarching one, with then interpersonal self-dysregulation, behavioral dysregulation, and cognitive dysregulation, all of which you've been hearing things about today. And this is just a reorganization of some of the known criteria. So it's seen as a pervasive disorder of the emotion regulation system, and that many of the behaviors, functions of both regulate emotions or a natural consequence of the dysregulation. The biosocial theory includes that there is an underlying dysfunction in this regulation system, which is interacting with an invalidating environment that produces a persuasive and pervasive emotion dysregulation. Emotion dysregulation is defined in terms of three major things that one sees very common with borderline patients: tremendously high sensitivity to emotional stimuli, an intense response to it, meaning so it rises very fast, it stays at a very high pitch for a long time, and a very slow return to baseline. And this is the emotional response often to some cue that has occurred internally or externally. And that this then leads to several problems. It makes it very difficult to regulate either up and down the physiological arousal as is needed, and can't turn one's attention away from the emotional stimuli. These are all things that we've sort of been thinking about in terms of the mentalization treatment. And this then makes it extremely difficult to process information, causes distorted thinking, hard to coordinate activities, organize oneself to achieve non-mood-dependent goals. It's impossible to control impulsive behavior when related to very strong negative affect, and it tends to sort of shut down and freeze the patients in terms of not being able to move either forward or stay put. In terms of the invalidating behavior, I think it's important to remember that there's a continuum of this, beginning with the sort of emotional misattunement we saw in some of Dr. Bateman's films, between the child and primary caregiver to the sort of frank sexual abuse. Just a moment about what I mean by this misattunement. One of the stories that I particularly like to tell about that is of a child who's walking down the street with the mother, and they drop their favorite penny in the grate of the sewer system, and it disappears into the darkness, and the child starts to scream and wail and fling themselves down on the grate, being one of these more emotionally sensitive children. The mother, being stunned and surprised by this, can't understand the behavior, inadvertently says, "There's no reason to feel like this. Don't feel like this. Get up, I'll give you another penny. Let's go." No ill will there, but an insensitivity to the child's experience. So the borderline personality disorder then is seen as to result from the transaction of this kind of biological vulnerability with invalidation over time. The invalidating environment is one which, as noted before in my example, either ignores or punishes behavior independent of the actual validity of it. Characteristics include that The invalidating environment will indiscriminately reject the communication of private experiences and self-generated behaviors, punishes emotional displays and or intermittently reinforces emotional escalation, and will oversimplify the ease of problem solving and meeting goals, such as, I can't do it, says the child, just try harder. The invalidating environment teaches an individual to then actively self-invalidate and search the social environment cues as to how to respond, no longer trusting oneself, looking outward to find what it is that defines their own reality. I think a very important thing to think about in terms of mentalization techniques. It also teaches an individual to oscillate between emotional inhibition and extreme emotional styles, and to form unrealistic goals and expectations. Okay, so here's some of the common therapy problems. These are all things which I experienced a lot that made me, I think, very primed up to learn this treatment. There's often a polarization of therapeutic orientation as either change or acceptance strategies. And this is something which I think in the in my experience was always something that made me feel very uncomfortable, that I was finding myself not knowing really where to fall and about this, and often being seen as someone who was pushing too hard for change. That was always my particular downfall. And actually, it reminds me that when I ran a program for John in the early 90s, it was an 18-bed program, and being the medical director, I felt I had liberty to do whatever I wanted in the service of getting people to change. And when I would arrive on the unit around 10, I'd take a tour of the rooms, and if there was anyone in bed, I would march into the room and throw off the covers and yank up the shades. And everyone said to me, "Oh, this is awfully brutal of you. What about accepting that somebody wants to stay in bed?" And I said, "Well, that's not acceptable here. In my house, they have to change and get out of bed, and the shades are up." So I was often criticized for being somewhat too much on the change side, and I count on my team to remind me of that and remind me that I have to be more accepting. The second problem was the inattention to patients' deficiency in coping skills, and I think this is probably the most important one to me in terms of why I became so interested in this. I think the, for example, Dr. Kernberg was saying, you know, the expectation that a patient can keep themselves safe. I think that I have found that that's an expectation that's often not realistic without a fair amount of skills training. I've actually been amazed at how few skills many of these patients who are enormously successful and competent in other areas of their life can have. So much so now that when I start working with anyone practically, certainly borderline patients, I always ask the following question. I say to them, if you are on your way to work and something incredibly disturbing has happened to you, and you are in a few minutes about to have to go and be there and show up and really work hard at a job that demands all your concentration, how do you put that disturbing thing on a shelf in your mind? And interestingly, I had to sort of ask myself that question in order to be able to ask anyone else that, and realize that it is in several steps of things that you have to do internally in order to do that. But I think I used to always assume that everyone knew how to do that, but they don't. The third problem was the therapist's own emotional difficulties in face of the patient's problematic behavior. And I think this is one of the reasons why there are, 10,000 therapists and trained in DBT to take care of all the needs of others, and those clearly not the most seriously trained clinicians, so why aren't there more people doing this? I think this is one of the big issues. All right, so problem number one. If one focuses on change, it tends to create a tremendous sense of arousal and feeling out of control. And that out of control and sense of arousal only increases. And with enough arousal, one cannot learn anything new and one cannot collaborate. If you've ever been very anxious and been asked to memorize a phone number, it's next to impossible. It's just simply too challenging. So that's the problem. If you focus on change, it's sort of a threat, an assault on somebody that they can't do it, makes them feel agitated. If you focus on acceptance, there's often the invalidation of this intolerable suffering, and that too leads to incredible sense of being out of control and arousal. And there too, there will be no new learning and no collaboration. And so what Marcia found out is that either one of these would lead to a patient shutting down, withdrawing, quitting, or attacking. We've all seen all of that. So her solution was to apply this dialectical approach in which she was balancing change and acceptance strategies in working with these patients. Second problem, the inattention to these skills. So when something happens that is causing the emotion regulation, up there on the top, the attempt to reduce or avoid the painful emotion is where the skill set belongs. And if that is lacking, it tends to lead to all the kinds of problem behaviors we know, whether it's cutting or burning or drinking or promiscuity or recklessness, interpersonal difficulties, which often will provide some relief. As we know, the research has shown, for example, that cutting is a very powerful emotion downregulator. So you get some relief from any number of these behaviors, but that only leads to the continued cycle of emotion dysregulation. Further, with this low distress tolerance up there as one of the skills lacking, it tends to lead to more and more behaviors in an effort to try and get some relief and to get away from the emotion dysregulation, all of which are fairly ineffective, although we're giving the temporary relief tends to reinforce the behavior, particularly in the absence of no new skills to try. So here, the solution to this was to teach two sets of new behaviors, change skills as well as acceptance skills. And I want to just say about this that one of the things I've come to appreciate about therapy in general that I think I really owe to studying this treatment is that I think it really is impossible to change anything until you've accepted it. And by acceptance, I mean the full embracing, both cognitively and emotionally, of what it is that you are experiencing in your life, in the here and now, that you have to reckon with. And I think more often than not, we try to avoid that acceptance and are trying to change something that we really don't want to acknowledge. So how to get over grief? Well, you have to really, truly accept the loss before you can move on and change things in your life. And I think that's an enormously difficult thing in general to learn, but I think given the black and white thinking of borderline patients, it's especially hard, and as we all know, they tend to sort of lie on one side or the other of these things, not realizing the interrelationship of the two. Third problem, the therapist's own difficulties in face of this problematic behavior. So if you have a client who's threatening suicide, it tends to make therapists extremely upset, feel out of control with a high amount of emotional dysregulation themselves. And when that happens, it's not uncommon that the therapist then experiences no flexibility and wants to try to control the client in order to control their own anxiety. Something that also happened to me in this program that I ran is, I think George Smith is here in the room to testify to this memory, is many of our patients would come out of the inpatient units. And they would come after increasingly shorter stays in those days and come onto this program, which while residential had open doors, and immediately they'd sit down with the nursing staff and they would sign a contract. They would have all kinds of things about the use of the facilities and expectations and belongings and things. But one of the last lines was that they also promised to never try to kill themselves or engage in self-injurious behavior. And I began to notice that there was this incredible agitation in the center as these new patients were coming, and all the staff was agitated, and there was a rush to get this paper signed. And as soon as it got signed, then the the clinicians and the staff were all sort of felt a lot calmer. So I, of course, didn't know what was being signed, so I went to read this thing, so I saw down there, and I said, oh dear, this is a problem. And I said, you know, you need to feel like you're in control, and you need to feel like you're not yourselves getting dysregulated by these patients, but it's not a good idea that you're feeling this way by the fact that they're signing this. Do you have any relationship with these people? Do you have any idea that they would mean that? Isn't it easy to just sign this away? So we're going to get rid of that, and yes, you're going to have to be anxious, and now I'm going to figure out a way to sort of help you be effective and be anxious. So it was a very interesting experience to see how a contract can really backfire in making you stop thinking, stop worrying, and stop really being paying attention to what's going on. But here, often, if you're not well-trained in a suicide protocol and they're threatening it, and you get highly aroused, and you become inflexible, you're wanting to control it to sort of make it sort of something that you can be more certain is not going to happen. It can be a huge problem. If you focus on acceptance, say, oh yes, your life is awful and is terrible, it tends to foster the sense of hopelessness and despair. The therapist starts to feel hopeless and despairing and doesn't like how that feels, feels stuck or trapped in an ineffective treatment, and then will abandon the treatment themselves. You see this all the time. I do many consultations of therapists who feel they simply cannot handle sort of the horribleness of patients' lives, that they can't tolerate thinking about it, and they feel stuck in it with the patient and want out. Okay, so this problem gets even worse because as a therapist, responding to a client's suicidal behavior tries to reduce anger, the despair, the terror. The therapist tends to become controlling, rejecting, attacking as a way of managing their emotions. And this leads often to very ineffective therapy because we've heard this morning, if you're overly nice, this is not necessarily going to be very helpful. And if you become too severe, you can sort of block any progress whatsoever. This is often, by the way, a point in time where patients get hospitalized. And often a good thing at a moment like that because the treatment is sort of unraveling. So the therapist, like the patient, shuts down, withdraws, quits, or attacks themselves. So rather than blaming the patient for manipulating, criticizing the patient for lack of not trying hard enough, or avoiding one's own, the therapist's emotional experience, insecurities, and worries, the solution here, again, is a dialectical balance between the patient and therapist modulated by the consultation team, which we'll go into a bit later. So these problematic polarizations between patient and therapist, acceptance and change strategies are addressed by a dialectical treatment philosophy, specific treatment strategies, and a consultation team. These are the three main avenues of satisfying the problems that were so apparent to me when I was doing this treatment. All right, so dialectics. So this is, you know, from philosophy. This is a worldview where everything is made of opposing forces, opposing sides. Gradual change leads to turning points where one opposite overcomes the other. Change is evolutionary, seen as sort of moving in spirals, ever transforming, not in circles. Another meaning of it is a debate, establishing truth on both sides rather than disproving one argument. I think Marcia at one point said that she feels that one of the main goals of DBT is to become somebody who doubts and is more uncertain than not. Okay, so in just broad strokes about how the treatment is put together, first step is the importance of structuring a treatment frame. It does require a consistent philosophy of care. And here I'd just like to say a word about, I think, really the fundamental difference, because I believe there is a lot of overlap with psychodynamic traditions, is DBT is based on learning theory. And I think if, insofar as learning theory is really looking at observable behavior, and not looking at underlying unconscious motivation. If you have multiple treatments going on simultaneously, it often can be obfuscating And if you are believing that there is a lack of skills necessary for higher functioning, to have one treatment moving in the direction of trying to understand meanings of behavior and the other one trying to move laterally, looking at places to intervene with developing new skill sets, it can be extremely problematic and confusing. So here are the philosophical assumptions. There's, you know, the behavioral sciences, which we'll get into, which is really about contingency management, operant conditioning. The Zen practice, which is really for the most part about mindfulness, the practice of being in the moment, attending to the moment, and training one's attention, which of course for borderline patients is enormously difficult to stay put for any amount of time. So this is a huge body of skills that have sort of been operationalized from the Zen practice of how to do that. And a dialectical philosophy. And these form the three main prongs of the treatment. It's very important to remember that standard DBT is outpatient treatment. That's what was initially studied. And that there are modes of treatment. The standard modes are outpatient individual therapy, a skills group training, telephone consultation, therapist consultation meeting, and then there are a number of things that are not part of the protocol but often in place: pharmacotherapy, inpatient hospitalization, residential treatment, couples, family, any number of things there. And just to review this briefly for a minute, I wanted to say something about the telephone consultation. I think this has often been misinterpreted as a sort of 24-hour hotline, and it's really not. I think it is about being available, but it's being about being available in a very dialectical way. And the function of this is, again, I think stems from the orientation around this being a skills deficit model, in that you're wanting to be available to patients when they are in a situation where they have become emotionally dysregulated, they've been trying the skills that they've been learning, and they're on a path towards self-injurious behavior or suicide, and you're wanting to help intervene at that moment with new learning. I think this is an enormously critical part of the treatment. And actually, I think when it's done effectively by a therapist who doesn't end up on the phone for another therapy session, can be enormously effective and short-lived. I often will get any number of calls in the first couple months of treatment, and then people stop calling because they know what I'm going to say, and there's no point saying it again. So I think, though, as a way of intervening effectively to terms of diminishing the likelihood of some of these behaviors occurring, this is enormously helpful. DBT structures treatment goals by stages of the disorder. And I think here, this is, again, probably much more important than any kind of contract. There used to be a contract in DBT. I think it's basically been abandoned for a more verbal, contractual arrangement. Pre-treatment really requires making a commitment and going over the agreements of treatment. I can't underscore how important this is. Commitment is taken enormously seriously. This sort of ties into what I was saying earlier about accountability and responsibility, that the patient really has to understand what it means to be committed to this treatment and all that it entails, and the responsibilities that each will take in making this happen. Stage one is the stage of severe behavioral discontrol, where you have a lot of the actions, cutting, burning, suicide behavior, where the goal is to stabilize the behavior. Stage one is what's been studied most extensively to date, with some more recent work in stage two. And my own experience is, in stage one, I find myself personally that I'm much more inclined to utilize DBT and then think about more psychodynamic exploratory treatments further on. Stage two, quiet desperation. This has to do with dealing with non-anguish emotional experiencing. This is where PTSD gets attended to most. Stage three, problems in living, non-complicated disorders, problems in marriages, jobs, and this is about looking for ordinary happiness and unhappiness. And finally, stage four, which is, tends to be about incompleteness and looking for a sense of spiritual satisfaction, dealing with issues around mortality and existential despair. And again, the kinds of treatments one can be involved in these later stages, particularly stage three and four, I think in many ways I tend to find people going into psychodynamic treatments now being better equipped with the necessary skills and understanding of their behavior in order to make better use of this kind of treatment. The treatment, DBT treatment, is organized around targets. As I mentioned earlier, the main targets of stage one are to first decrease life-threatening behaviors, next therapy-interfering behaviors, and finally quality of life-interfering behaviors. This would have to do with style of life, drinking, problems, any number of things that interfere in having some sort of effect of life, being homeless, and to increase the behavioral skills, mindfulness, distress tolerance, interpersonal effectiveness, emotion regulation being the four main skill sets of DBT. So the next thing is doing behavior therapy, which I have to say, when I started learning this treatment, the last thing I'd known about behavior therapy had been from college, learning about Skinner's boxes. So I'll confess that I had tremendous disdain for behavioral treatment, and I didn't think it had much to offer. Always saw it as an adjunctive treatment, and I've come to appreciate an enormous world of incredibly sophisticated literature about doing it. A student, I still feel I'm in the process of learning. So DBT orients itself around things that are really considered major CBT related, behavioral analysis, developing insight from that, solution analysis, with the things in the middle here being the ways in which one does that, skills training, contingency management, exposures, cognitive modification, and the tools by which one does do that is didactic, orienting a patient to what you're doing and getting a commitment to the work. In terms of what behavioral strategies DBT adds to CBT, I think the main things here are the targeting strategies, that there's a hierarchy that is developed in terms of what's being worked on, that there's a lot of attention paid to observing limits. It's enormously important in DBT. Doing chain analyses, micro-analyses over a period of time of what is happening that leads to the dysfunctional behavior. Opposite action is a major force of trying to block maladaptive behavior in terms of identifying what the emotion is and the action inherent in it and trying to encourage acting opposite to it as a problem-solving technique. And the focus on in-session behavior is both a model for understanding behaviors in their life outside of therapy as well as past behaviors, again from a learning perspective. Next is adding validation. I think a lot of this relates to some of what Dr. Bateman was talking about in terms of the attachment model. Here in this treatment, it's defined as the action of validating or making valid, strengthening, reinforcement, confirming, establishing or ratifying as valid. Synonyms: confirm, authenticate, corroborate, substantiate, or to verify. Step four in this is applying dialectics. It's not really right to say it's step four because this is over the overarching aspect of this treatment, but it is also a specific form of treatment strategies. And again, just to review, it's combining elements of universal, formal, and relativistic thinking. There is truth, and truth is evolving over time. It's replacing the either-or with and this and. If the therapist's job is to help the client synthesize polarities, to search for what is left out, to both arrive at truth and to be willing to let it go. So it's always a way of looking for what makes sense in the moment and at the same time be willing to sort of have it be replaced. And both therapist and patient alike have to do this. It's also seen as practice, meaning you can't do this treatment without encouraging not only your patients but yourself to practice everything you're teaching them to do. So it behooves all of us in doing it that we need to know these skills and be practicing them ourselves in order to be more effective teachers with them. So DBT is practice for both. So the treatment is really based, as I've been alluding to, there are change strategies on one side, acceptance strategies on the other. We'll be going into this in depth this afternoon. Here on one side we have problem solving, validation on the other. The irreverence and reciprocity are two of the main stylistic aspects of treatment, reciprocity being the more connected, validating part of the relationship, the irreverence, the way in which to throw someone somewhat off balance, to be open to something new. Consultation to the client, environmental interventions. Again, you're always trying to promote a client taking responsibility for themselves and managing their environment and their times at which you need to intervene in the environment directly. Team consultation is down here at the bottom as the way in which to modulate all of this and to review it. And I can't underestimate how incredibly important this is. And it should be remembered that without a consultation team, the treatment is really not considered DBT. These four components are sort of the essential aspects of it in terms of there being an individual therapy, skills group, telephone consultation, and a consultation team. And I was thinking when I was listening earlier to Dr. Bateman that I think in some way this mirrors the attachment paradigm for the therapist, because it's an enormously holding environment to be in, with a lot of perhaps marking and mirroring that goes on to help work through problems, to reciprocate back, to help one another in these enormously difficult situations, to feel on board with one another. And without that, I think the work becomes sort of very much more impoverished. And certainly in my experience, when I haven't met with my team for a while, I feel much less on top of my game clinically. And of course, a lot of this, you know, too, is, you know, in videotaping all of our work or as much as we can. You know, watching these tapes and exposing one another to, like Dr. Bateman shows with his patient, is very helpful in really seeing what you're doing. Because ultimately, we have all these different treatment modalities, but we're all trying to observe the same thing. I mean, there's something going on which we're observing and trying to make inferences from and theories from. So I've always found it very comforting as part of how I enjoy teaching is to actually have a videotape of what you're doing. So you can't really lie about it. So I will stop here. I think I'm right on time. And we will go on with ferreting out all these various things that I've alluded to.